I'm Darius Larson, campus pastor at the University of New Mexico. And tonight's theme is entitled Providing Sanctuary, Aiding the Enemy? ? I was expecting a smaller group tonight because of the topic, and then I was fearing of hardly anybody because of the weather. But I'm glad that there were several of you who decided to come out. I'm curious, how many of you kind of know something about what we might be talking about tonight? Okay. How many of you know a lot about it? Good. help out. How many of you know Spanish? Good. Can you tell us what this word means?
Hope. Wish.
What?
Wish. Hope.
Gosh, you got it right away. Most people think it means just to wait. But it's a chant that many people are chanting now when it comes to dealing with the whole issue of Central America. Because as they wait, they also hope. And it's a good one-word litany for us. As we wait for maybe a few other people, maybe I can just share with you a few resources that you might want if you want to really get into this. One is All Campus Pastors got a 3-page memo from our headquarters in Chicago on it, on what we should do and what we probably shouldn't do. But you won't be... The best, I think, one source book on it is Congregational Guide to Helping Central American Refugees in the United States, Seeking Safe Haven. It's sponsored, it's put together by a lot of groups, including our Lutheran Immigration Service out of New York, American Friends, Church World Service, Interreligious Task Force on El Salvador and Central America, and Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Services. It's a good one volume thing, and there are, I think, two or three available over in the bookstore. Another thing that's in the bookstore I have not read, but it looks good. It's a personal journey of a refugee called In Search of Refuge, and looks interesting, but I have not read it. But there's about 10 copies over in the bookstore. Whenever they order that many, it must be good. Have you read it? Okay, great. And also, the right over in our resource center over here, there's a couple packets of a couple of these things left from the Church in Central America Task Force on Central America of the American Lutheran Church. There's a whole host, everything you've ever wanted to know, and then some about Central America and the American Lutheran Church. Those of you who are not American Lutheran Church, you can still learn a heck of a lot by picking up this packet of information. And two others that are over in the bookstore. I just went over there today. I couldn't believe it that they had all this. Public Sanctuary for Salvadorian and Guatemalan Refugees, Organizers, Nuts and Bolts, and Sanctuary, a Justice Ministry, both put out by the Religious Task Force in Central America out of Chicago. Also, next to probably issues like nuclear war, when you read all sorts of National Catholic Reporter, Christian Century, and Christianity in Crisis, almost every issue of those magazines deal with the issue of Central America, and more often than not, something to do with the Sanctuary Project. Now, that some of you have just gotten in, what are we talking about? And what I want to try to do tonight is give very briefly, and probably too brief, an overview of what this whole issue is. And then if those of you who know something else about the whole issue and want to disagree or add something that you feel is very important for us to understand the background of it, please do so. And then, if possible, and I'm almost glad that we're a little smaller group tonight, if we could act then as a congregation, let's call it FOG, you know, Family of God, that's what the parish is up here. And let's see if you think about where you stand on the issue and where you think some of the people in your own congregation stand on the issue, how do you think they would feel and how do you feel about this issue? So maybe by in 55 minutes, you know, we can vote on the issue of whether or not we would want to provide sanctuary. Now that's too much to ask, but that's the direction I want us to flow. First of all, right off the top of the bat, I still can't remember the person's name who wrote Against Principalities and Powers, letters from a Brazilian jail. On page 100, he writes this letter which says that all of us talk incessantly about justice, and we all have awareness of issues. What we lack is the courage to act upon that awareness. And then he closes his letter off, pray for us, pray for all of us in prison, both inside and outside the walls. And I think that's part of what this issue is all about. In Christianity in Crisis, it gives a little biblical background, and I just want to share briefly some of the issues. Yahweh was the first to proclaim sanctuary, commanding Moses to set aside cities and places of refuge in Cana where people could seek asylum from the blood avengers. During the 17th century, the whole North American continent was seen as a sanctuary from the religious and political persecutions of Europe. Sanctuary became a part of the accepted understanding of what it is meant to be American by both people here and around the world. The Statue of Liberty says, "Give me your tired, your poor, yearning to breathe free." In 1850s, after the passage of the Fugitive Slave Act, making it illegal to harbor or assist a slave in gaining freedom, religious people and churches became key points along the Underground Railroad. Churches became sanctuaries, defying the law. More recently, during World War II, monasteries hid Jews in Nazi Germany, and so forth and so forth. In the New Testament, the understanding of sanctuary is broadened to the whole idea of hospitality. Too often today within the church, the breaking of civil law remains an unquestioned taboo. And then a little longer quote from a pastor of the Wellington Avenue United Church of Christ Church in Chicago, who they declared themselves July 24th, 1982, as a sanctuary. He says, "This is the time, and we are the people, to reinvoke the ancient law of sanctuary, to say to the government, you shall go this far and no further. This is the time, and we are the people, to provide sanctuary for those people fleeing the blood vengeance of the powers that be in El Salvador. We provide a safe place and cry, enough. The blood stops here at our doors. This is the time to claim our sacred right to invoke the name of God in this place, to push back all the powers of violation and violence in the name of the Spirit to whom we owe our ultimate allegiance. At this historical moment, we are the people to tell Caesar, no trespassing, for the ground upon which you walk is holy." Ronald Reagan has said, "I want more than anything I have ever wanted to have an administration that will, through its actions at home and its international arena, to let millions of people know that Miss Liberty still lifts her lamp besides the Golden Door." And remember, the lamp, the quote is, "Give me your tired, your poor, yearning to be free." Also at the church I quoted earlier, the council chairperson and potential felon, the congregational's decision to offer sanctuary has immersed them in political and theological reflection on the plight of Guatemalan and Salvadorian refugees. And quote, "We learn about immigration policies and law rapidly," she said. "Even though Salvadorian and Guatemalan refugees meet U.S. code requirements of the Refugee Act of 1980 and are recognized as refugees by the United Nations, the State Department refuses to grant them their proper status. Of the over 15,000 applications by Salvadorian refugees in the past 2 years, seven have been granted. The INS, it's the Immigration Nationalization Services, prefers to deport Salvadorian and Guatemalan refugees back to face torture and death. The INS currently deports about 1,000 Salvadorians and hundreds of Guatemalans per month. In Chicago alone, there are over 7,000 official refugees, with many more remaining hidden, fearful for deportation. INS law refuses Guatemalan and Salvadorian refugees political status, considering them economic refuge, in spite of a civil war which has taken the lives of 34,000 Salvadorians and 20,000 Guatemalans in 2 years. And now, what does the INS, the Immigration Nationalization Service, say about this? Currently, it dismisses the sanctuary project as insignificant, a ploy of the churches for publicity. Quote, "We're not about to send investigators into a church and start dragging people out in front of TV cameras." Bill Joyce of the INS Council said that. "We'll just wait them out, wait until they leave the church. This is just a political thing dreamed up by the churches to get publicity, a game to pressure the government to allow Salvadorians to stay here. If we thought it was a significant problem, then maybe we would look at it. But there are plenty of illegal aliens out there." The problem is they're starting to look at it now, and I haven't heard if the verdict of the lay Catholic worker, Stacy somebody, she was declared guilty for harboring and transporting illegals in Texas. But the sentence, I don't think, has been pronounced yet. Has anybody heard? I've been here for a week and a half, but it was supposed to be coming down. So there has not been, in fact, I should probably get to that and then throw it open. There has not been a true case dealing with the how illegal this is, or what might happen to a congregation who declares themselves a sanctuary. And to declare themselves a sanctuary once again is to say that we, a congregation, will be willing to aid. In other words, try to help resettle them, or at least to help take care of them until the political situation in these countries settle down a bit so they can go back to their country. And the legal risk currently is harboring of undocumented aliens is a felony, and you can get $2,000 fine and or 5 years in jail. Conspiracy to harbor is $10,000 and or 5 years, and smuggling is $2,000 and or 5 years. And the one interesting issue that I see here is, unlike things like tax resistance, unlike things like standing in front of the white train and other things, this issue is an issue dealing with corporate civil disobedience. Not just individual conscience, but it's a way of the people of God saying, is this a faith issue, so we want to make a stance? And if we do, as our NLCM colleague Jim Carr stated in legal briefs and everything else to campus ministries who are considering this, that you must take a roll vote. Everybody has to be, if you vote yes or no, that has to be recorded. So in other words, each individual person could be held accountable, not just the church itself. So when you vote at a church council meeting that let's provide sanctuary, you are saying that I would be saying that I am willing to take the consequence of that, which right now is a $2,000 penalty and or up to 5 years in prison for this act. So that's somewhat brief and somewhat oversimplified, but is there anybody else who wants to add something to the overall scheme of this before we get into the discussion of it, or some clarifications? Yeah.
I lived in Panama for 11 months, and I lived in the 11th Salisbury. pointless. And I guess first of all, I'll give you, try to give you...
Can you all hear?
No.
If you can't hear, do this, and that will signal me. And if people want to talk up there that I can't see, raise your hands and come around so I can see. A little louder.
I lived in Panama 11 months. I lived in the Galapagos Islands, which is claimed by Ecuador, for 20 months. And when you live in that part of the world, you look quite differently at things than you do here. It's said that South America is a place of people and of fortune rather than a place of law. And as far as I can tell, that's correct. You tend to live by your wits. In Lima, there are many street in Peru. There are many street people, and if you ride the trains in Peru, like up in the mountains, in Cusco, in that area, if you ride the local trains, you have people with their produce, people with their pigs, people with their bags that are bigger than themselves. You got people trading beans, you got people trading cocoa, jello that they make, sitting in the train station and label out milk for you. Everyone lives pretty much on the street. Not everyone, but I think quite a few, maybe half the people in Lima, I don't know. Ecuador is quite a bit the same. Guayaquil, a town I've spent a little time in, is 1 or 2 million people. Pretty well built for a South American town. It's tropical. Anywhere you go there, within a block, you'll have food, mostly all kinds of fruits, papayas, bananas, sandias, which are watermelons, citrus fruits. A lot of trading goes on, a lot of bartering. You can Jew people down in your price, you come to an agreement. Your whole monetary system is set up on what you're willing to pay each other rather than going into a store. And there's this price, and so you pay that price. And down there, it's not like that at all. It's an entirely different world. Well, you have these people in this kind of a world really being envious, I guess, and jealous of what they see in North America. What they see are, to quite a degree, are cars. I think probably are new homes. Quite a bit more financial security than what they have there. My feeling in Panama when the Salvadorian thing was going on at that time was that the Salvadorians existed for more than exporting cheap bananas to the United States. So you have two systems. You have this system of people and places where you can make immense fortune if you're some kind of foreign capitalist. Or you have the North American system. And so you're talking about two kinds of system. You're talking about a Protestant religion and a Catholic, basic Catholic religion of the Latin countries. You're talking about, I think, sort of a coldness between North American people and a warmth between Latin American people. You're talking about people there that think in terms of family. Here we talk about people in terms of individuals. And, okay, so you have these people and they see the kinds of things that they want from North America. And a lot of that, I guess, we've gotten because of our financial dealings with those countries. As an instance, we have the debt system and the loan system set up in such a way that the interest rates are so high for Argentina, Mexico, Brazil, and the rest of the countries that they cannot really get out from under them.
What I would like to do, and I think what you said underscored one point, and then but I would like to keep it somewhat narrow to the Sanctuary Project, and as it relates to that total picture, which we need to see, I think that's great. And one thing, I think what you're underlying is that the Immigration Naturalization Service states that all these people are coming here only for economic reasons and not for political reasons. And if it's only economic reasons, then let's deport them. But if it's for political reasons, and therefore their life may be in danger if they go back, then maybe we should grant them asylum. And they're saying it's only economic, and you laid out clearer than I ever could some of those economic reasons. Now, I don't know if that's what you're trying to do or not. Do you want to say anything more?
Yeah, I was trying to give you the picture of what I see when I was there. Mm-hmm. The other thing that you notice when you're there, like I'm on the low end of the economic scale in the States, I'm on the high end of the economic scale when I'm in Latin America.
Yeah.
And I don't think there's any way that you can say that when you come to the States that there isn't a hope for even economic opportunity. I think everyone that's come here is beyond what they say about for their freedom of religion, beyond what they say of just their freedom. I think there is this hope in everyone that comes, because it is one of the richer countries in the world. So I don't think you can throw that out. That's enough for that base right now.
Okay. Did you want to say anything? No. Okay. Yeah.
We had two refugees that were staying in the Episcopal house that was next to our Lutheran Campus Center, and we found many ways that we could support them. We couldn't house them. We didn't have the facilities. But we had taken a petition in our community and then sent it on through our directing committee, and one of the pastors at our campus center formed a document, and she formalized it through that directing committee, and then we took it on to the, I guess it's Lutheran Campus Council, it's the hierarchy in the Lutheran campus.
Uh-huh.
And so that document is still being processed about supporting the issue and the stance, even though we can't host the sanctuary people in your facilities. Mm-hmm. But we found many ways of supporting these two refugees, and just by being open and friendly and helping out at the Episcopal house, it seemed like they felt more comfortable or more well adapted.
That is another, besides providing sanctuary, there is one of supporting sanctuary of other places, and I guess you're saying the other places, this Episcopal house. And where and what are the personal legal risks there are unknown. It depends on if they come in when you're serving them soup or something, in one sense. I found this interesting statistic too. The Immigration and Naturalization Services figures for October 83 to March 84 show, and by the way, footnote earlier, that it's been about the same amount of people from El Salvador and Poland have applied for asylum in the United States during this period. Now, from October 83 to March 84 showed 796 denials to the Poles and 5,130 to the Salvadorians. And now what are some of the reasons for that? Our administration supports the Salvadorian government. So to say political asylum, it gets us into kind of a political catch-22. But we're pretty clear on how we feel about the Polish government. So it's easier for us to say political asylum. I don't know if you want to speak to any of that at all, being from Poland, but that's not the issue tonight, I guess. And the other issue that do you want to share what you said?
Well, I just, when Darius read those statistics to me, I thought also that it always seems to be easier for Northern Europeans to immigrate to the United States, but there's always been a problem with oftentimes Southern Europeans and people from other continents, and I think that's operating here a little bit too.
So not only a political bias, but a racial bias as well, or at least an ethnic bias as possibility. So just wanted to throw that in.
What are those numbers again?
796 denials to the Poles, 5,130 to the Salvadorians.
Yes. Right. You mentioned Guatemala and El Salvador. What is the INS attitude toward the ongoing refugees from Nicaragua, from the Sandinistas in Managua?
I do not know. Does anybody know?
They're more able to get political asylum.
Yeah.
Not the Sandinistas, but the Solistas.
Yeah.
Because there's a very large refugee community continuing out of Nicaragua as well. Throughout Central America.
Okay. If I could, this was passed by the United Presbyterian Church USA June 1982. And maybe I'll change some of the names here to make it more Lutheran and see if you think we could pass such a statement here tonight. You know, if we could kind of have this be ourselves here. Whereas, refugees from El Salvador and Guatemala are fleeing to the United States to escape the persecution, torture, and murder of their civil war and torn homelands. And whereas, in El Salvador alone, more than 34,000 civilians have been murdered in the past 2.5 years. And whereas, the United States government has hunted down, arrested, detained, and expelled 20,000 Salvadorians in the past 2 years. And whereas, many of these refugees have been tortured and killed upon their return to El Salvador and Guatemala. And whereas, the Office of the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees and privately advised the Reagan administration that the United States may be violating international law and endangering thousands of lives and by expelling Salvadorian refugees to their war torn homeland. And this is the last whereas. Whereas, a federal judge recently found that the U.S. Immigration Naturalization Service and Border Patrol has used physical abuse, coercion, and intimidation against refugees from Central America to force them to sign voluntary departure forms. Therefore, be it resolved that the Family of God Lutheran Church do the following. One, urge the President of the United States, the Department of State, the Congress to grant extended voluntary departure legal status, to grant extended voluntary departure legal status, that says it twice, to refugees from El Salvador and Guatemala. What that term is that until the political situation is stabilized in those countries, they're allowed to stay here. So they're kind of green card or holders, I guess. Two, request that the program agency, synods, and other bodies of the Lutheran Church assist Central America refugees in order to provide legal assistance. What it's basically saying here is to request that we, the Lutheran Church, will try to provide legal assistance, bail bond funds, food, housing, and medical care to these refugees. Three, urge congregations to actively resist the immoral and illegal policies of the U.S. Immigration Naturalization Services by declaring their churches to be sanctuary for refugees from El Salvador and Guatemala. And four, ask the committee, whatever our committee is on social justice, through investment to seek ecumenical ways in which bail bonds collateral might be secure through church investments. And then five, commend to the national convention. Well, that's immaterial. That's the last one. If we each of us think in our own minds, if we were to vote on something like this, and the catch, I guess, the one line catch would be the whole issue of sanctuary, I guess. There may be other ones there. If you were in a congregation now and you were asked to vote, and the vote meant that by saying yes, you could be in prison for 5 years and fined $2,000. Do you think, you know, would you vote yes or no? And if you vote no, is it because you're afraid of going to jail? Or do you vote no because you don't think this is a thing that the church should get involved with? Or you think the refugees are really economic refugees rather than political refugees or something else? And if you vote yes, why are you willing to risk so much of your own self in order to vote yes for such a thing? Is that clear? Okay, who wishes to speak? We have good a half an hour, just right. I bet you this is what would happen at a congregational meeting too. Don't ask me. I wonder if they would have a quorum. You can speak in general about your congregation, and I would also like to push you to state how you think you would vote and why also, but you know, we can do both.
I would have to research the issue much more thoroughly before I would sign the document also.
Okay. Yeah.
In the congregational discussion, that my point would be to that statement, as well as to say I would vote yes for it, is that I'm not even sure a researching of the legal status, whether or not it's economic or not, is relevant to a Christian church offering hospitality to a stranger. And I'm not sure that our call to offer hospitality is based on the person's background or why they came to us. And I realize that can open doors to letting a criminal stay at your house because you offer that person hospitality and try and protect them. But I would vote yes, and I think there are many times as Christians when we need to jump into the water, even if we're not entirely confident.
I think the difference I feel here, if there were someone knocking on the church door saying, I'm the place, then that would change the issue totally. But having an anonymous paper without a person attached to it becomes a different situation. At least, I'm from Portland, Oregon, and I'm not really, I think there's just two or three at the last, I must be working out by now, but that I had recently heard that we're being in a refuge situation.
What's your address? I'll have you knock.
But it's sort of new on the horizon.
Mm-hmm. And the other issue, the beautiful thing people say about this issue is twofold. One, you actually do have the hospitality issue and you actually do help people in need. But two, whether or not anybody ever comes because of this action, you are making a very political statement about a very moral and faithful concern that we must tell our government, these people are saying, that enough is enough and we must stop this now. You know. Anybody else before we're trying to share what you spoke to? Okay, here and then here. The two people who spoke before.
Okay, now this is from experience I had at the time when I was wanting to go up a tree plant. Well, Mexicans had already taken the job so that they were gone.
Mm-hmm.
Possibly I could have been doing something else that should have been. But the thing is, okay, you're looking at, and I'm again taking an economic argument.
Mm-hmm.
But you're looking at a country, our country now, where the unemployment rate is higher. And you have new people coming in who are willing to take the low paying jobs and in a sense cut down the wage scale. I think that you have to consider that when you're taking these people in, that you can not only help them for a while, but you sort of need to find jobs for them, you know?
Mm-hmm. Good point. And there's a whole list in each of these organizer books, all three of these, very similar to, I think most of you may be familiar with what we did with Vietnamese and Cambodians and other people who came in the Lutheran Immigration Service, setting up these committees and all these other sorts of things and setting up food for them and apartments for them and all these sorts of things. And it takes massive organizational work to do that, you know, once and if they come. And I think that's an important, you know, you have to have the commitment, not only the commitment to go to jail, but the commitment to work for 1 month to 2 years, maybe with a family who knocks at your door, and whether or not people are willing to do that and share that load. Here and then here.
I still don't see the difference between, well, 30 years ago when a lot of immigrants came in from countries that were taken over by Russia my mom and my grandparents. But I see there's a different intention in the government. You know, it's a government the United States is supposed to be opposed to, as or a government that they support to giving aid and things. But I still feel like it's not that much difference. I mean, why is there more sponsorship? Because when my grandparents and stuff came over, they were sponsored by a family or something like that. And of course, they helped them find jobs or put them up or whatever. But it wasn't as much an economic burden then, and I realize it is more of a economic and job burden now, but I still feel like there shouldn't be that much difference. You know, the Constitution and the amendments haven't changed.
So you would lean to vote yes?
I would lean to vote yes.
Okay. Yeah.
I want to talk a little bit about some of the economic issues that are involved with this thing, because I was involved with the Indochinese problem, and I wasn't really satisfied with the result. I saw a lot of people doing a lot of fine things to Indochinese families who came in and taking care of them. But in the end, I think that they formed their own cultures. In the end, they regressed to their own kind of ghetto. And they found it, as other peoples have in the United States in its history. The Swedish and Norwegians and others have in fact formed that. That seems to be a kind of a natural process that goes on. But the view that I think the congregation had of what they were going to do for these people was much different than the result. What actually finally happened to them. And I'm sure there's some great success stories, but there's some others that really don't work out so well. These people eventually drifted off, went other places, were never seen or heard again from the congregation, although the congregation extended themselves. They did not fit into the culture. They were furnished jobs, some of them pretty well paying, had opportunities. But the distance of culture and the distance of technology was something that could not be totally bridged. When you bring people into our culture, and you bring them in for a long-term purpose, you know, I think that's one thing. What I hear being said here is that this is sanctuary. That by being sanctuary, it is in fact temporary. However, I don't hear any limitations being put on it. That's where we get into trouble, is where we don't define what we're trying to do.
Okay.
And that's a problem that I think I would have personally with it. Not the fact that we're trying to keep people away from firing squads or whatever. But where do we put limits on? How do we deal with this human being? How do we treat these people? We say we're finding a job. With the Indochinese, it was a different story. We had a whole network, a whole bureaucracy of the way of sorting that out. We had boards to bring them in, ways of qualifying congregations, to do all kinds of other things. This, on the other hand, is a different story because it is, in fact, illegal. It's an entirely different picture. So I have lots of questions about it personally.
Now that we're deeply into it, I'm going to ask people to keep their statements as brief as possible. Before, when there's a few hands up, I was glad for lengthy ones. But we have one, and no? Okay. Then two, and three, and four. Remember your numbers. One.
Okay, I think this piece on what he's saying. First off, I'm basing this on, we've had a few refugees sponsored through one St. Louis Presbyterian in St. Paul, Minnesota, and a couple other ones. We've had them speak at our college. They're only planning to stay temporarily. They fear for their lives, and they would like to get back and reunited with what family is left that they know of. Two, here, the one at St. Luke's, they may provide them odd jobs around, but they kept him pretty much in the church. When he's out in the open, he wears shades and sometimes a mask simply because he is, and there's always somebody accompanying him because he's afraid that somebody from the government will try and take him. The government knows that he's there, but they won't touch him in the church or anything. They know all about it. They don't want to touch it. But there's a lot of fear that they still can't walk around here even and show their face, because if the picture gets back, they might put pressure on the family or brothers and sisters who might be serving or being forced to serve. So I think part of the sanctuary process is putting pressure and showing the government that there is a war going on down there, that it is not just economic reasons that they're coming up here, that they don't feel safe to go back because of the situation there, and that the that our government, if they're linked favorably with the government down there, that they should have some influence, at least saying, why are these people coming up here, and why are they fearing for their lives from the death squads or, you know, whatever.
So would you lean to say, I'm just trying to take a poll here. I don't even know if we get, that's not the major issue. I'm just curious.
I lean yes on
okay.
the sanctuary.
Okay. And I guess you would lean on the no side, or you would be on the no side.
Probably.
Yeah. Okay. Number two, whoever two was.
I lean yes. I think because it's a humanitarian matter, and as far as the economic thing, and as far as the church having any control over what happens, I think when you're dealing with the Holy Spirit, you're liable to have some surprises. You may think you know what you're doing and what you want to have happen, but that often isn't what happens. And no one was more surprised than Central Lutheran Church when they were having a baptism service for 21 members and 41 people were baptized of the Hmong community that they had been having a special service for in the basement of their church. So I think leaving the door open for what the Lord has in mind can make wonderful things happen. And naturally we have to go through some bad experiences for those good ones to happen. But I think we have to stick our necks out and be willing to stand on the side of the oppressed.
Just a footnote, totally maybe unrelated, but people moving all over the place. We were in Houston, and Houston now is the second largest population of Oriental population in the United States. Climate-wise and everything else-wise, it's very similar. Fishing industry and stuff. And the Lutheran church that we worship at happens to have a Chinese Lutheran church there too, which is packed to the scene. Not that we do this in order to get members, I would hopefully say, no matter if they're baptized, you know, that might be a fringe benefit. Okay. One, two, whoever was three. Yeah, okay.
This isn't a vote of yes or no at all, but it is a concern. It's a question that comes out of the same kind of economic necessities that I see in looking at a question like this. In the Statue of Liberty and its give me your needy and your poor, this country has so many needy and poor already here. I worked in Boston and worked with street people for a few months. And I saw such a huge number of people that have been very much ignored, except for by some churches that give them sanctuary, but for only about an hour in the evening once a week. And for the rest of the time, they're left on the streets. And it frightens me to think that we're going to invite more people in and ignore these other people. And then the people that we invite in, the same thing could happen. This country is only so large, and I see a crowd problem happening and just not enough.
So in one sense, if people vote yes, let's vote yes to all the people who are already here as well, and aid and show hospitality to them. However, we may vote no because can we really do that, and are we already overtaxed?
Can we spread ourselves as thin as we
okay.
Yeah.
We lived in Eastern Illinois, and we had a particularly offensive congressman who, whenever he spoke about El Salvador, raised the specter of millions of people rushing our border and clogging up America with people, with the lesser beings, which is basically what he implied. Now, contrasted with that, in my program in the university that I was in, there were several people who were from other countries, and a couple of them were from the Orient, Japan and Korea. The thing they remarked about, the thing that they thought was really remarkable about the whole United States, even the East, is that it was so empty. They just couldn't believe how empty America is. And even Illinois, which has a lot of people in it, is empty to them. And they said, there's no way that Americans can stay that empty, you know, with all the people in the world. And I think, and that got me thinking, I think we could accept a lot more people and still look empty to someone from Korea. Our population density is so, so low compared with the East. And we really still have quite a bit of economic vitality, and it's a kind of, some people would say it's proven that every time more people come into this country from other countries, the economic level of this country actually rises.
So you would lean yes or vote yes? Or?
Yes, yes, because I'm saying that there's no, this problem isn't really there. It's the same old kind of, you know, second, third, fifth generation immigrants saying, we can't accept any new immigrants. It's the same as it was in when Norwegians were coming here, or Irish, or, you know, name your group.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5. One.
Well, it seems to me as though we have such wealth in this country. We have such natural resources and land and whatever that compared to any other country in the world, we have more to offer, and we have, you know, almost a responsibility, in my opinion, to do something. The other thing is, what is, you know, could we talk about what is the biblical imperative here? What is the, you know, the Christian call? Because to me, you know, if you said I was hungry and you fed me, I was thirsty and you gave me drink, you know, I think that there's something else.
Two?
I was working with Hispanics at a health center in D.C., doing social work, and a lot of them were Salvadorian and didn't have their papers, and so they couldn't get jobs and so on. And I guess part of the reason I started to get interested in the sanctuary movement is that I think that the U.S. government has sort of forced the movement of the Salvadorans to the U.S., and I think that our involvement in what's going on in Central America has forced all those people up here for political reasons as well as economic. And so I kind of come at it from a perspective of, as an American citizen, my government is intervening and I want to be responsible to other humans who've been affected by my government. And so I'm not Lutheran, I think that it's from.
Okay. So, but you would vote yes if you were Lutheran? I got your combo. Yeah. 1, 2, 3. Yeah.
A couple of minor points, and that's that because of where the empty land is, I mean, one of the things that we do is provide a lot of food for the rest of the world. And so if you're using that empty land for agriculture, then you are providing a service as it is. The other point, again, a minor one, is simply that, and Argentinians talk about this, that 10% of the Argentinians live in the United States. And, well, that can be here or there, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, just that there is a real desire. Yeah, let me ask you a question, too.
Okay.
One thing I either had an addendum on this motion before, or the thing we raised. That the sanctuary, if it was adopted, be used as a political vehicle, because our government, you talked a little bit about our government's power down there, whether we consider ourselves to be intervening there or not, the fact of the matter is, it's two sides fighting with U.S. weapons, and the only country probably that has the power to make a peaceful solution right now in El Salvador is us. And I, as a member of that congregation, would push that we push for that solution. And I think that answers the question, if the guerrillas by some ungodly manner are able to win that war in El Salvador, there's going to be a flood of refugees in the United States. If the present government, with our continued help, manages to win that long battle in El Salvador, we're going to have a flood of refugees in the United States. If the United States uses the power it has to to help create a peaceful solution, which I think we can do, that wouldn't happen. And so I think that's one thing to recognize there. And I think the sanctuary movement can help that happen because it raises that issue instead of keeping it going.
Five?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, you said almost the same, but precisely we have to distinguish and look at it as a strictly political issue. I mean, it's not economical. If you look at the figures of people coming from Poland and finding the warm welcome in this country, I mean, not talking about any economical issue, and you know, we have to remember that would Poland be in the same setting, with the same issues, the same political, economical problems in Central America, would be the same way oppressed by the United States as Central America is today? Because precisely what Poland is doing is fighting even further, to go further in the owning the country or economy by the people than it is at the present time on the socialistic level. So I think it's a really double standards. And what I see that the sanctuary issue is nothing else but the manifestation of the church saying no to the government, which is unfair in the political, intervening in the political issue in Central America. And it has nothing to do with the economy. Those people do may come for the economical reason to this country, but by and large, it is they might be some extent attracted by the economy, but it's primarily economical, the political issue. I mean, it's originated in the United States.
I'd just like to say in passing, I spent some months in Mexico this last winter, and Mexico was very indignant about the United States returning the wetbacks and so on in such numbers. And then I found out that the southern border of Mexico has an army down there turning back the Hondurans and everyone else who's trying to get into Mexico. And whether you're north or south.
All right, just a footnote to that. It's about from Chicago to El Salvador, about 2,500 miles. The trip, usually on foot, car, hitch, whatever, is about 5,000 miles that the person has to take. It takes, before, Western Airlines could get them back in a couple hours. Western Airlines, because of protests and everything else, is no longer doing that for the INS. And also, no other, I don't think, major airline has so far taken up the contract from the INS, because they're fearful of the flood of reaction and a possibility of a boycott, probably much larger than a Nestle's boycott.
But I would definitely vote yes, because it's only in numbers that we can make ourselves heard as individuals in a instance like this.
Some dinky airline took up, I mean small, some small airline did take up the flag, by the way, that doesn't need to commercially stop.
Okay.
I would vote yes if it came up in my congregation, but it's not likely to come up in my congregation because we haven't done the homework to get us to the point where we even think of it. And I think that's a real consideration here. If community isn't exist, if recognition of the needs of poor people, oppressed people in your own city are not being addressed by your congregation, it seems that establishing a congregation sanctuary is probably not entry-level response for a congregation. That's a big step to make, first off, and it gets even bigger when you have the refugee in your congregation there day in and day out, and you suddenly wonder after a few months, my gosh, what are we doing, and what can we do now? So my concern becomes, if you jump into it too quickly, and you split the church so badly that there is no church there to act as sanctuary, what have you gained and what have you done to the ability of those who are not with you, their ability to perhaps respond in an appropriate way? I think it's a big step to take if it's entry level.
By the way, I think you need 2/3, at least it'd be only 1/3. You know, splitting. Yeah, over here. Yeah.
I just want to second that. It's not the question of giving sanctuary to one individual, but it's the question of what you do with your limits. if you don't use the resources that you have rightly and you overuse them, you are likely to have exactly the opposite result of what you want to get.
And in this case, what would that be?
They might well be deported and go back and have a worse feeling about their situation than they had in the first place. They might well find themselves at the mercy of not even having welfare benefits in the United States and being worse off than the average street person. Then where are we? Well, all I'm saying is, not voting no, but rather voting yes, but voting yes to something that's definite in the church. So often in the church we vote this yes to something that is so indefinite that you can't even put your finger on it. And that is, I think, sometimes a sin, not always, but sometimes a sin.
Yeah, we got a couple more minutes here and then here. We'll see what time we are.
I would vote yes, and at the risk of being redundant, I really agree with what three people down here had to say. And we are a nation of immigrants, and I really feel that there is a lot of racism that is involved in whether we should let people of Central American persuasion to come into this country. My brother, who is a pilot in the Air Force, I know, and was stationed in Texas, would make flights with weapons down to South America. He couldn't even tell his wife. She just said, oh, you're going to South America. I know, because you're taking an interpreter. And when our country was founded, we took in people for political, religious, and economic reasons. And why can't we do that today? I think it goes back to the Bible statement about Christ saying that we should take these people in, and the whole hospitality issue.
I can remember the church, some churches were set up as sanctuaries in the draft resistance movement, too.
That's another point, yeah.
Now, but what I don't understand is the church the only institution that can do this? And I mean, is that something that, is that a unique thing for the church in America? And what legal rights, or what's the legal precedent of that? I guess I'm just curious.
Yeah. I'm not sure. All I know is it has not been tested, but we have this thought that sanctuary means that separation of church and state, and therefore nobody can come across because this is holy ground and you can't bring your guns and all this. What the opinion of the lawyers for National Lutheran Campus Ministry states is don't count on it. They will come in, and they can come in, and legally they can do that. Whether they can do that biblically is another matter, but legally they probably can. Do you have a point?
No, I just said legally it's nothing. It's the same for tax resistors, draft resistors. The only reason they don't is for the publicity. You could claim your own house a sanctuary and be in the same legal boat as a church. So any institution could do it, and it's simply the publicity reason that they haven't, that okay. The churches have any.
Or I would rather say the prophetic reason, but you can say publicity. I think if I could possibly close it by making two comments, maybe three. Our Holden theme is this summer is one Lord, many members. Who are those members, and what do we do with those members? Whether they be the person on the street, down the block, or if they happen to be Salvadorians or Nicaraguans, for that matter, too. Another thing is, I heard tonight, we talked about our culture a lot. And I think the one thing coming from New Mexico that I'm so aware of is, what is our culture? Is it Anglo? Is it Hispanic? I mean, the Hispanic culture has been in what we call the United States of America for a long time. The oldest Christian church is in Santa Fe, New Mexico. You know, so maybe, you know, we can play that one out a bit. Is it black? Is it Oriental? Or is it what our Holden theme is all about—a blending or a mixture of a uniqueness and a homogenizing of all of that? something to reflect upon. And then back to my original opening comment, we talk incessantly about justice, and we all have awareness, or at least we seek awareness. And do we have the courage to act upon that? I challenge the people who said yes, at least, or at least lean yes, to at least research this issue. This was just surface stuff, tip of the iceberg. Research this issue, and if you still think you say yes, then talk to your local church. See what happens about it. Try to push the issue however way you think will serve the purpose. Just don't say, this was a nice forum here, we can talk about it, and then we can go our way and forget about it. And if you said no, research the issue too and push that no a little bit further so that you really know what you're saying no to, and for the people who said yes, what they're saying yes to.